by the speaker. And I want to welcome all the members that are here, and especially welcome our guests who are also joining us on the committee. Mr. Smith, Mr. Korach, and Mr. How do you say your last name? Manoogian Odell?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, we're very glad to have you here, and we hope that this will be a productive and enlightening exercise, and one that we can end up having some conclusions that can be of value to the legislature. For the last couple of years, I served as a member of the Education Committee or Quality Education Model, the council that former Speaker Lundquist put together, as did Representative Westland. He attended many of the meetings. So we already have quite a background on the issues relating to how do you determine in a legislative context what's the appropriate level for school funding. I want to let everybody know right off the top, that's not what we're here to discuss in this particular committee. There were two committees that were appointed by the Speaker a few months ago. One was to review the quality education model, and this committee, which is concentrating on school finance. I met with staff to talk about what we should set up as the committee goals, and you have a list of those in front of you, numbered 1 through 8. And what I want to do is let you know that I think we'll be able to tackle and successfully at least make recommendations on all but number 7. And if we could come up with a number or with a solution for number 7, that would be great, but I don't think that that is a an expectation that we ought to place on ourselves. I just don't think that's completely realistic. However, I do believe what we can do is take a look at the distribution of funds that we have available both at the state and local level and talk about are those funds being appropriately spread around to meet the needs of students in Oregon's schools? Are they appropriately being shared among districts that have different needs? And are the services provided by ESDs effective? Are they funded appropriately? Can you copy the committee goals? Okay. And also then some of the other issues that we tend to not address very much in the school funding formula, and that has to do with the capital needs of schools. We seem to concentrate on the operating costs and the per student costs without regard to the fact that where there are more students, there's also more pressure on space and building and construction, and we typically rely on local voters and local districts to carry the weight on that particular part of the total picture. So this is an ambitious agenda, and what I want to do tonight is to get to know each other a little bit, begin the discussion, and start from a common platform in terms of understanding where we are coming from with the school finance system that we have in the state now. And to do that, I've asked Steve Meyer from the Legislative Revenue Office to give us a presentation. Steve is the analyst who concentrates on school funding and probably is more knowledgeable about that area than anyone else in the building and where we've come from and where we are today. So as we go through this process, I encourage you to ask questions and I want you to all have a good understanding of where we're starting from so that as we discuss what our options are in the future, we'll know at least what we are facing today. Now, Craig and William, why don't you come over to this side of the room, unless you have the mirrors over here that are able to see backwards and read backwards. You can join us up here. That's the last one.
Ooh.
Oh, no. This is one of the rooms without the camera. So does anybody else have any introductory comments or remarks that you'd like to make prior to the beginning? Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just interested in terms of as we look at these database initiative projects, is this going to be something, I don't know in terms of who controls that information, are we going to be able to look at that as a, you know, review in terms of the school financing, in terms of to see if that is sufficient enough information, if we could put factors in terms of cost factors to say in terms of districts, because in different categories, in different regions, different cost factors, they could adjust school finance so that in the context of equalization, in terms of, I'm not familiar enough with the debt of this project to understand who controls that information and discuss something you think is going to be within the purview and our ability to discuss.
I think that the database project will be something that we will be able to look at as a helpful tool, especially in preparing this district. But what I might do is, Walter, are you able to speak a little bit on what the database project is and where it is? Not right now, but maybe after Steve is finished with his presentation. Would that be something you could do for us? Okay. Well, I think that would be helpful because the database project is different from the quality education model, and it would be nice to know what its differences are. It's housed in the Department of Education, and sort of get an overview of what the goals are. So I apologize for asking you spontaneously, but you showed up in the room, so that makes you a candidate. So anyhow, Riffin and Pell, we'll get that answered at the conclusion of Steve Meyer's presentation.
Additionally, I'm just curious in terms of, as we go through this, assuming in terms of the weightiness of this is going to be something that we're going to go through the interim working on, rather than something we're going to do in the tuition meeting. I guess you'll be breaking down this schedule and taking topic by topic. And
right. Frankly, you know, I haven't had a great deal of time to put together a work plan.
Oh, really? Are you doing something else?
There have been some other activities going on most recently.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we will do that. However, I want to make it clear that my interest in this process is not to have a series of endless meetings. My goal is to have some specific targeted achievable goals, some knowledge and some background to get there, and then to make our recommendations as best we can without going through an overly long process to get there. So while we will meet at some point during the interim, I don't expect it to go for an extended period of time. Okay. Anybody else? Steve, why don't you get started?
Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. What I want to do this evening is basically try to walk you through the school finance system as it is now and start out with some big picture presentations and work then towards talking specifically about K-12 and ESD funding. Quite a few slides on the equalization formula, how it's put together, what's behind it, what drives it, what has been the result of using that formula since 1992, and then what kind of equity do we have now from that formula, how has that improved over that time period, and where we might go with that, and then also talk a little bit about ESG. I don't know if we can squeeze all that in the time we have, but if not, I can come back if that would be helpful. So I'm going to try to go fairly quickly. You have the handout to go by as well as what's on the screen. So if I'm going too fast, slow me down. If I'm going too slow, speed me up. Right? So some of you have seen this before, maybe not recently, but this is basically the same information that I used for orientation at the beginning of the session for the revenue. Okay, what do K-12 dollars pay for? There's about 530,000 students in the school system that need to be taught. It takes about 34,000 teachers and aides, 19,000 support staff, about 1,200 school sites, and 198 school districts to be operated. So that's what the state and local dollars are paying for in a broad term in terms of what's it take to provide education for a K-12 student. Just a quick reminder here that besides those 530,000 students in K-12 school districts, there's another 1,000 in state schools. That's the schools for the deaf and blind and youth corrections institutions. And then besides that, we're totally ignoring the private sector, where there's another 50-some thousand students. Those are just rough numbers. So it's a big operation. You have schools virtually in every town and every neighborhood in the state, and more so than even where you'll find post offices. So you need to just be aware of the magnitude, I guess, of the whole operation. That's what I'm trying to get to with these couple of slides. Also, again, the big picture for resources. Don't want to go through this in much detail, but basically just to show how they have changed.
Excuse me. Change the last one.
Steve, can you back up a little bit? I've got, you know, K through 12 students, this is page 2, school districts, 530. Are you saying that's how many students there are?
On average, yes.
Well, that's just a little misleading when you say school districts.
Okay.
But the
students at the top in the main heading was supposed to take care of that. Okay. Not.
Okay, so what you're saying is that in the public system, what the number of kids in school districts in public schools is
530,000.
The number of kids in state schools that are public is 1,000. In private, then you break it down that way. Is that correct?
Yes.
St. Patrick's?
I also have just a quick question. Is that, I've been confused with this ADM, ADMW whole piece, and Steve and I have talked about it before, and so are these physical bodies, or are they based upon all the weights and those kinds of things?
These are bodies.
These are physical.
Yeah.
One individual.
Yes. Yes. Bottom and the feet. We'll come to a whole slide that deals with that.
Yeah.
That counting process.
Thank you, Steve.
All right. Notice that this is for 1996-97 in terms of audited resources. That's the latest information that's available. Just a time series to show you a couple of things. Notice at the bottom that the local portion has decreased over this time period as Measure 5 phased in. Then once it was fully phased in 96-97, local revenue increased a little bit, but this doesn't show any effects from Measure 50. Over that same time period, you can see how the state share has increased, and then there's also federal dollars, some intermediate resources from ESDs that flow to school districts, and then part of the resources is the beginning balance. And then the bonds are a net figure, so that it's looking at bond sales less bond repayments in terms of how that's changed. And you can see that there's been some variation over that time period in the bond amount too.
Do you have a figure, do you have a chart in terms of where you map over the top student enrollment growth? I'm just curious in terms of if the increase in resources is consistent with increased students in terms of if...
Yes, there will be slides on that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the yellow bar is net bonded indebtedness?
Yes.
The yellow portion. Okay, thank you very much.
Steve, the federal dollars, do you have some sort of an average number per student that those are across the state, how they're distributed or...
I don't have a per student number for those. A lot of that is for the lunch program, for preschool, for Title I, those kinds of things. But I think it would probably be fairly consistent or uniform on a per student basis. But I haven't checked that.
So it's primarily categorical money, but
yes.
It's federal, and does it be acquired by districts turning in requests or reports, or is that a state function?
Some of both.
Just to follow up on Mr. Wilson, the yellow minute bond indebtedness, is that state bond or is that including local bonds as well?
No, just school district bonds, local bonds here.
Okay.
And then a follow-up as well, Mr.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in 96-97, how many dollars is that yellow bar representing?
Well, 300 or 400 million, I would guess.
documents.
Well, that's a difference. But okay.
Somewhere in that neighborhood. I don't have the individual numbers with me.
Okay. This is a group that's going to ask a lot of questions.
Yes. I don't think we'll get through this evening.
We're motivated.
Yeah, we're dedicated. We're committed.
Okay. All right, let's finish probably everything tonight.
Okay.
Yeah, let's take this out of our hair.
It's been trying to give you, again, a big picture on the expenditure side for K-12. Again, audited data from 1996-97. If you look at about the bottom half of the circle, there's three instruction categories for services and materials, salaries and benefits, and capital and other. That adds up to about 54% of the total. And then the support parts at the upper half, about upper half of the circle, you have all, again, the same categories, salary and benefits, support services and materials, and support capital and other. Those three add up to about 46% of the $3.6 billion total represented here. So, again, this is an all funds. If you were looking at just general funds, the numbers would be a little bit different. But this takes into account all funds. The support salary and benefits would include all of the people, the guidance, health, attendance, psychological services, transportation, food service, all those kinds of employees are in the support category. So virtually everybody that doesn't or isn't directly in the classroom involved in instruction. So that's kind of the dividing line for those two broad categories. Again, most of it, if you put support salary and benefits together and instruction salary and benefits, you're looking at about 70% of the total being related to personnel.
Steve, is that fairly consistent across all 198 school districts? Is that percentage breakdown?
I haven't checked, but I would expect it to be.
Okay. And that may be something that the database project can more closely reveal to us from district to district. Right?
It would be available also from existing data, but it's just more difficult to get at. The database project, too, you'll have to wait a while to get all school districts in that database. Okay, normally I have some slides on comparisons to other states, but I wasn't going to talk about those tonight in the interest of time, so let's just move on to K-12 and ESD funding. And I just want to start out here with going back to the state school fund that it was adopted in 1991, and that was the beginning of Measure 5. What happened then was that, as you well know, school funding primarily shifted to the state and removed local control over what that funding level would be. What you have now is a state still controlling the sources of local revenue. The state controls that the district, local districts, can raise property taxes. The Constitution controls how much those property taxes can be for the school. And then you have the state still controlling the state school fund and other funding to the district. So the state is still the primary player in this. But even with the change from Measure 5 and Measure 50, the Constitution requiring a uniform system of schools has not changed. But I think the perception of what that constitutional requirement now means has changed, because we have gone from primarily local funding to now primarily state funding. And because of the court cases that deal with those situations in other states that are primarily state funded. But this has led to the equalization formula and going through that whole process of trying to treat each of the school districts in the same way. But how far we've come in that process will be touched on in another slide. This is just a reminder that the state school fund where can it go? Or where did it go in 97, 99? It didn't all go directly to K-12 school districts and ESD school districts. There was a little bit within the formula that goes through the Youth Corrections Education Program. A little bit was set aside for out-of-state placement for the disabled that go through programs out-of-state. And then there was also a specific category for the ESD Network Technology Program, or commonly referred to as OPEN. So we tend to think that it all goes to school districts, and maybe we know that some of it goes to ESDs, but there's also some other categories that benefited from state school funds in 97-99 anyway. Again, looking back to the current biennium, 97-99, the state school fund came from two sources, lottery and the general fund, with the lottery only accounting for about 11% and the general fund 89% out of the total $4.15 billion that was appropriated to the state school fund. So that's where the state dollars are that we want to talk about. Now let's shift to the local revenue that's included in the equalization formula. Local property taxes is the major source of local revenue, and it's taxes collected, which means whatever the district gets, it could be prior year taxes that are owed. The bulk of it is current year taxes, but again, it's a mix. Another source is private timber taxes. That's what's now called the privilege tax, or what's called the severance tax on private timber, and it's cut. There's a bill currently this session that may change that and go to a land tax, so that source may shift and not exist as a timber tax anymore. The common school fund, that currently has been about $10 to $12 million a year in the current biennium. What it will be next biennium isn't decided yet, I guess. County school fund isn't a large player anymore. It's about $4 million a year and will probably become smaller since the counties no longer have to make a contribution to the county school fund. The state-managed county trust force, that's primarily the Tillamook force and the revenue that goes to school districts from that force. ESD equalization fund, there's two ESDs, Grant and Wallowa, that levy as an ESD over the whole ESD territory, so that they have the same tax rate over that ESD territory, and then share that revenue with both their component school districts. And that's taken into account as a source of local revenue. There's a real minor amount of revenue in lieu of property taxes and supplantable federal funds is virtually zero, so I won't even bother to try and explain what that is. The other thing to make note is that All of these sources of revenue here are pretty much statutorily required to go to school districts. So what sources of revenue do school districts have that aren't in the formula? There's still some. Any gifts, bequests, donations, those kinds of sources, interest earnings, other things that school districts have that aren't included in the formula, primarily because they are on a voluntary nature. If they were included in the formula, there would be a strong incentive for those voluntary contributions to go away. So to keep those going to the school district, they are not included in the formula revenue. Any questions on local revenue? All right. Pretty familiar with all of those sources. Okay, then to look at K-12 and ESD.
I just do want to clarify one thing. When we're talking about the state school fund, 97-99, $4.15 billion, general fund 89%, lottery 11%. That takes into account the local revenue collected as well.
No, those are state dollars.
The whole $4.15 billion, I thought that was state and local.
No. Okay. The local is another billion and a half or so.
No.
No. 4.15 billion.
For the biennium.
For the biennium, that's what we came up with as state and local last time. What we've been talking about now is 4.7951, whatever you want, state and local, right?
Oh, state. We'll go back and look at the cover sheet. It's over $6 billion a year, or $6 billion a biennium. Right. Before, when you look at both state and local together, the current split is about 30% local revenue and 70% state school fund dollars. And there you have the state school fund, 70% being $4.15 billion for the biennium. Okay, if you, in looking at it in a little bit more detail, is the local revenue is about 27% property taxes and 3% of the other local sources. So, primarily property taxes and state school fund dollars. Now, that's the brief overview of funding. What I want to get into now is the formula itself and how the state school fund is distributed to K-12 and ESG. For the K-12 portion, we want to divide it into two parts, the permanent equalization formula and temporary constraints to that equalization formula. The formula is permanent. Equalization formula, the permanent portion of it, is permanent only in the sense that there's no sunset to it. Right? It's not in the statute for this biennium or next biennium. It continues on until changed. So that's the permanence of it. Could be changed at any time, though. The distribution principles that guided the way the formula was put together back in 1990 by the 91 legislature. Basically, four broad principles. One, share school funding sources statewide. And so that, the method to do that was to allocate all state and local operating revenue, not just state revenue or not just local, but both. So the formula takes both into account. Second, let each district decide how to spend its allocation. A way of maintaining local control on how it's spent, not how much is there. And the method then was to give state aid in a lump sum and not through a series of categorical grants that are basically dedicated revenue. Third, adjust funding only for uncontrollable cost differences. If it's a controllable cost, then the district should deal with it. It doesn't have to be in the formula. If it's a cost difference where the cost is higher for one district than in another because of the kinds of students that are in that district and the district can't control the number of those students that it has, then the formula should probably try to compensate the district for that. So the method basically was to try to justify those revenue differences for different school districts in some rational manner. And then fourth, avoid incentives to increase district allocation. So the method then was to try to keep the classifications of students to a very small number and perhaps set some overall limits on how many students would be in any one of those classifications. And I think that will be clearer as we proceed with how the formula is developed. Are there any questions on the overall guiding principles back in 1991, anyway?
Any questions on this distribution principle? I think this is a very important thing to take note of because this is an area that I'm going to want to spend some time on when we get back to talking about the weights. And I think especially this point two and three, suggest funding only for uncontrollable cost differences. That essentially forms the justification for what elements are in the weighting system. And then point two, give state aid in lump sums, not categorical grants. This is where we get into a lot of misunderstanding when people say, oh, look, you're doing a special education, that's a 2x weight, therefore that's what it costs. And that's not what it costs, and that was never an assumption. The assumption was you'll have some kids that are 2x, maybe some that are way more expensive, and probably a whole lot that are much less expensive, but that's a distribution process that goes on at the local district, not at the state level, to accommodate dollar for dollar the exact cost of every particular category.
Okay, with those principles then, let's look at the permanent equalization formula and how those principles are represented here. This is the general format for the equalization formula. Basically, the first principle is in the first block, dealing with both state and local revenue, and not separately. The second portion then is to have a measure of students, some basic funding level for those students, and then adjust that funding level for various cost factors. Right, so the cost factor portion dealt with the third principle, to adjust for uncontrollable cost differences. Overall, the district has a source of funds from this, and it decides how to spend that money, so that's how the second principle is included in the formula. So there's components to it. This is, once the amount is determined, it's up to the district to decide how to spend it. All right, what we want to do now is to look at, go into some of these components of the bottom box.
Okay. I'm just curious in terms of relating this formula back to the court case and equalization in terms of what it said. We have to treat every school district equally. Because I know they didn't go and they didn't talk specifically about formulas and that. But I'm just curious in terms of how this relates in terms of that sort of imposition or requirement.
The summary of the Deschutes County cases relating to this?
The Withers case?
Mm-hmm.
The Withers case pretty much, well, I'm not a lawyer, so, but the Withers case was primarily based upon the constraints on the equalization formula, right? What they call the flat grant districts and stop loss districts weren't being treated the same way as equalization districts. And so when we get a little bit further, you'll see why that created that case, I think. If not, that we can bring it back up.
And Mr. Chairman, my understanding from the Withers case is that it did not put the legislature in a tight straitjacket when it comes to quote-unquote equalization, but allows some discretion, rational, reasonable discretion in terms of how you might apply factors, and then allow the legislature a period of time to fulfill that requirement.
Right, which is another way of saying equalization and equal distribution is a moving target, depending on what factors exist in the world and what decisions are made by the legislature.
And Mr. Chairman, it doesn't mean the exact same dollars for every student. It allows for some reasonable differences that can be justified in terms of funding.
Right. Now, Steve, just one other question. State revenue plus local revenue. In 97-99 biennium, what was that total?
I don't have that with me, but it was somewhere around $6 billion for the biennium. Because the state portion was 4.1, and then there was the local dollars in addition to that.
What's the bonding? What's the bonding?
Mr. Chairman, I think he's right. I think the total funding was just over $6 billion. And if you break that out to a per student basis, per year, it's about $5,700.
State and local.
Yes.
Sorry about that. We've moved. Okay, any other questions?
Okay, spend some time on the students and cost factors and base funding for students. Now, adding some more detail to that part of the formula. Cost factors included our student cost weights. We'll have more detail on the teacher experience adjustment, transportation costs, and then beginning in 99-2000, the new facility costs that become part of the formula. Now here's where we get to how students are counted. That causes some problems. Average daily membership is the beginning point, and that's just an average over the whole school year of what the membership of that school district is on a daily basis. So just looking at an average over the whole year. The ADMR is the measure where kindergarten counts as a half of a student because they're only there half a day in most cases. So when we're talking about ADMR, we're talking about kindergarten only counting at half, so that is going to be a little bit less than ADM. But it's very easy to be talking, use say ADM when you really mean ADMR. Right? So we usually mean ADMR when we say ADM, unfortunately. Then the next step is ADMW, which is simply a weighted ADMR, and it's weighted to adjust for differing student costs by all of the weights that are taken into account in the formula. And then we have what we call extended ADM deficit, which is what the formula actually uses as its student count. That is simply the higher of the current year or the prior year weighted ADM. So when we're talking about the formula, we're talking about extended ADMW almost always. Unless specified otherwise, pretty much assume that it's an extended ADMW count when the context is the distribution formula.
And Steve, membership essentially means enrollment, not necessarily attendance. Is that correct?
Correct. They are residents of the school district and the responsibility of that school district. It's not an enrollment figure. The enrollment figure is what's the count on a specific date. The average daily membership is close to an average enrollment over the school year.
Okay. How are they going to distinguish between if it's the total number of kids, how do they know whether those kids are coming to the public school or going to private school or home school or something else?
When we're talking about these numbers, we're only talking about public schools.
Okay. So the membership is?
In public schools.
The number of kids who have indicated that they will be attending public schools.
Are attending public schools for that year.
Okay. Good
question. Isn't there some time period in which they're in, and if they're absent more than 10 consecutive days or some period of consecutive days, then they are dropped and they it affects the ADMW?
Yes.
So there's a formula which calculates what ADM is.
Yes. Well, the school districts report their ADM and ADMW.
So for the purposes of the formula, is it a specific day that that ADM is calculated in terms of, so that I'm just curious in terms of, or is it a series of dates that are then averaged together for the purposes of how much does the state cut the check for the district for? How is it an average of reported dates, or is it just a running average?
It's an average for every day during the school year. For those students who are residents of that school district on that day. So you could have, for example, 100 students for half of the year and 200 students for the other half of the year. Your average daily membership would be 150 for that school year.
Can I answer your question, Patrick?
Okay. Okay, student cost rates. This is what you were talking about a little bit earlier. I divided these into two categories. The first category is the special education and at-risk. I'm not sure that there's a real specific meaning of at-risk students, but basically those that have some degree of risk of not finishing their high school education or receiving a diploma. The total weight is the number that you see there for the special education, which is the individual education program. That's a more technical name for special education. The student is one weight, and if that student is an individual education, has an individual education program, there's an additional weight for that student for a total of two. So that's consistently how to read the total weight numbers. The student itself counts as one, and then there's an additional weight attached to that student or to the student count for the district for each of these categories. They are listed in the order that adds the most weight to the count. So the IEP students add about 56,000 student weights to the total a year. That's the weight.
Mr. Chair?
Okay, Bill.
Are they not limited by district? Within the district have a cap of the number of students they can place into an IEP for the purpose of the formula?
There's no limit to how many students can be in the have an IEP program. There is a limit on how many can be counted for the formula, yes. Initially, it starts out every district can have up to 11%. If they have students that are more than 11%, they have to basically appeal to the Department of Education for a waiver for to exceed 11%. There's an approval process that is gone through, and maybe none to maybe 30, 40, 50% of those students above 11% receive a waiver to be counted in the formula.
Are on the rest of these, are there any caps on the FTEs as well?
No. The students in poverty, that's based on census data, has about 20,000 weights. The English as a second language or the bilingual programs at about 13,000 at a half weight. But that category has been the fastest growing of all of these. It's doubled since 1992-93.
And if I recall your numbers, also that is the one way to redistribute the greatest amount of money, is that correct?
I believe that, yes.
Yeah. Because, as Bill indicated, there is a statutory cap on the IEP, even though it has over 50,000 weight for our students, so it doesn't really put much money around because virtually everybody is at approximately 11%. So the one that pushes the most money from one district to another district is the ESL weight.
Those students are more concentrated in a few districts. The pregnant and parenting, an extra weight, but it's only about 1,800, and then the others add about 1,000 weight.
What was that one? The pregnant and parenting?
About 1,800 to the weight.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative.
See, what you're saying is it's not 1,800 pregnant and parenting, but it adds 1,800 weight to pregnant and parenting.
Yes. And that data for pregnant parenting and neglected and dyslexic students comes from human resources. So it's an outside source or count for those weights that get added in. And again,
what's the threshold on a poverty, Steve? You know what it is?
Well, the income level for the family? No, I don't offhand.
Okay. For the purposes of this formula, that's what I'm at.
I don't know if it's the same definition.
Okay. And we look at that later on.
It would be the census definition for that census year. And I don't recall what that is.
I don't know if the weight is 20% for the purposes of the formula is 50% or 100% or 150 or where the line is.
If you just reinforce what the chair was saying, when the formula was put together in 1991, there wasn't a lot of information to go by as to what these weights should be. It was kind of best guess or best opinion of legislators who were familiar with the programs in the school district. There was a couple of maybe national studies to go by for special education that would suggest that it should be an extra weight of one. But there isn't a lot of background that supports the numbers that were chosen, the weights that were chosen. So that is an area that could use some more study, and hopefully the database initiative will generate some information that will help indicate whether, yeah, these are pretty good weights, or no, they should be adjusted either up or down. The other category of weight,
sure. And none of this can be kind of student in multiple categories. Can you be pregnant, foster student?
Yes.
English, second language, and have an IEP?
Mm-hmm. There's a limit, overall limit, total weight, I think, if you have three.
2 8.
Or two of extra weight.
2 8 5.
But I don't think any student would reach that.
So we cap a student at a 3 in terms of the weight.
There's some weights associated with grades and school situation. We talked about kindergarten already. The elementary and Union High District students are only in Harney County now. The rest of the old elementary districts are now joint with their high school districts. But before that time, the weight was 0.9 for elementary students and 1.2 for Union High School District students, basically to try to reflect the belief that it costs less in the elementary schools than it did to provide an education in a high school. And that was the adjustment. That worked out the same as having a one weight per student in a K-12 all-grade school district. The same major, only it's just split up between two different levels.
Mr. Chairman? Steve, isn't the ADMW about twice, 1.2, 20% more than the ADM?
Yes.
It's about a 20% factor, isn't it?
Yes, the 1.2 represents a 20% increase for that student, high school student.
No, I'm sorry. I'm comparing the number of students identified through ADMW compared to the number of students at ADM or ADMR.
Yes.
It's about a 20% increase, isn't it?
Right. I'm almost there. Okay. Remote small school, that varies by the school level, whether it's an elementary school or a high school. It varies by grade size for that elementary and high school, and then it also varies depending on the distance of that school from the nearest school of the same grade level. So if for elementary schools, for example, if the elementary school is between 8 and 12 miles of another elementary school, there's a distance adjustment that reduces the weight. If it's over 12, the distance adjustment goes away. For high schools, if the range is between 10 and 20 miles, then there's a distance adjustment factor that reduces the weight. Once you get beyond the 20-mile restriction, then there isn't any distance reduction anymore. I don't have the graph to show that because I didn't really want to get into the remote small school this evening, but just be aware that, yeah, it can vary by those factors. Okay, here's where we look at the student count comparing ADMR to ADMW and how that's changed over time. ADMW has grown just a little bit faster than ADMR just because of the weighting categories and the number of students that are now in those categories. And yes, the weighted count is about 19 or 20% higher than the ADMR count. Okay, now we want to move on to the teacher experience adjustment. Basically, this is trying to account for cost differences for teachers that are in the higher wage categories or reimbursement categories because of their years of experience. And that can vary from district to district, what that average teacher experience is. The statewide average is about 13.9 years of experience. And to try to take that extra pay for more years of experience into account, there's the adjustment of $25 per year per student. So if the district average, for example, is 14.9 and the state average is 13.9, there's $25 more for that student. But it also works in the reverse order. If the district's average experience is below the state average, and you're subtracting $25 per student because of that. So it shifts money around among the districts so that the sum is zero. It doesn't give more or less money, it just shifts it around depending on the level of the teacher experience in each of the districts relative to that state average number. Some are below, some are above. Questions on how that works. It's not a large factor. It was originally intended to cover about 70% of a step increase for years of experience. But that $25 hasn't changed since it was adopted and used in 1992. It's a little bit dated, and it won't represent 70% anymore. From the work that I did last week, it represent about 50% of the step increase now. Transportation costs. The formula takes into account 70% of the approved transportation costs, and those approved costs are what you have there for transporting elementary students if they live more than a mile away from the school, high school students if they live more than a mile and a half away, or transporting students between school sites if they want to take a class at another school site that isn't offered where they normally are. It also covers transportation for handicapped students, field trips, and room and board in lieu of transportation. There's only one room and board school in the state for Crane Union High, so not too much in the way of funds for that category, but it does add up to a substantial amount for students for that one district. Okay, so we've talked about, well, let's see, a chart on transportation, as you can see how it's changed over time and how much that 870% is of that total. There was a substantial jump in 97-98. That was the year that Portland, I think, had to renew its transportation contract, and it was at a substantially higher cost, so that kind of drove the state totals higher for that year. There was a little blip in the chart there to account for that. And it adds up, that 70% now is about $140, $150 million statewide. Okay, formula revenue. You can see here that the transportation dollars are only about 3.6% of the total. The rest is referred to as general purpose grants at about 96.4% of the total. What this doesn't have included in it, well, this is 98-99, so it doesn't have any facility grant showing up here yet, but it will in 1999-2000.
Well, I'm getting a little confused because it keeps jumping years, so I can't sort of keep track in terms of the relationship to the other different graphs in here. But why are we now down to $2.84 billion? I'm just curious. What is missing in this? We're stepping down to $2.84 billion?
Because we're talking, this is 1 year versus 2 years.
Okay. This is a single year, okay.
Yep. All right, and then the new facility grant that will begin this next year is calculated as 10% of construction costs. That cannot include any land costs in that total. Current law limits the amount that the 6% can be to $10 million in any one biennium. And then the funds aren't for the facility itself, but for the contents and equipment that would go into the facility that might not, or that can't be bonded. And it was passed in 97, but was delayed in taking effect in 99-2000. So that's why you won't see it in some of these slides, because at the time that I put these slides together, it wasn't in the data yet. I left it out on purpose. Okay, now that we have these cost factors,
I'm just curious in terms of, so for the definition of new facility, what is that when it kicks in this year? It kicks in this year?
Yes.
Is that facilities that opened up this year, or facilities that opened up within the last 2 years, or is it just, how do...
The reimbursement is in the year that the facility opens. So it will have to open in 99-2000.
And then they get the money regardless of whether they had a bond that covered the entire content of the school.
Well, under the major five restrictions, I don't think the bond is going to cover the entire content.
So are we talking equipment, not books, or would this cover books and chairs, desks?
Yes.
Library, I mean, I'm just curious in terms of what would this not be for? Is there anything that's not construction?
Right. It would be for the building, for the land, for the any improvements to the land, anything that basically is movable inside the building. So it could be lab equipment. All kinds of things in the building. All right, now let's go back to our general formula and put some detail to our equalization formula for the cost factors and student counts that we've been talking about. Right, we still have state and local revenue has to equal something. And remember, the student portion is measured by now ABMW extended. The transportation cost factor is the transportation grant of 70% money. And then the middle portion is an amount that takes a couple things into account. One, it starts with $4,500 as a targeted amount for weighted students. And that $4,500 is in the statute, a totally arbitrary number chosen in 1991. That $4,500 is adjusted by our teacher experience amount, and then there's another factor that balances all of the dollars to what's available. And it's just a ratio that's calculated to keep the amount that the formula allocates equal to the state and local dollars available for the district. And we'll have a couple of examples of that to show how that calculation takes place. But this is the core of the formula right here. So any changes that are made to the formula will be reflected here. The only addition to this probably should be after transportation grant, you say, plus a facility grant. The change that we know. All right, trying to put some numbers now to the formula. If there's 5,000 weighted students and they have this district has a teacher experience factor 1 year above the state average, $4,500 has increased by $25. The factor to balance the total is 96%. And then, so that's all multiplied out. And then to that total is added $1 million for the 70% of transportation costs. Means that the state and local dollars for that district would be $22.7 million, or a little over $4,500 per weighted student. Now, by putting the $4,500 into the formula, the balance factor, the 96%, has been less than 100% so far. There's some business managers, when they would see this number reported to them from the Department of Education, thought they weren't getting all the dollars that they should because it wasn't 100%. They thought they should be getting $4,500 and not reduced by some percent. With the funding levels that's possible for next biennium, that percent will probably be over 100%. Well, I'm curious what the reaction is going to be now from some of these business managers when they see more than 100% on their reports, whether they think they'll be getting more than they should or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But this is how many flat funded districts are we going to have in this next funding?
Depends on the funding level, but. The number of flat grant and stop loss will probably be less than 25.
And from a percentage of students?
Right on that, probably less than 5%.
So, because I know my district in the past, since it was a stop loss or whatever district, they basically got 90% of whatever the formula run was based because the flat funded districts got funded 100%, and if they misreported how many students, and they had actually more students, they still got the per student rate, and then everybody else balances it out at the end of the day, and on average, my district can get about 90% of whatever the runs are. So we see that percentage going up because everybody, soon everybody will just be in the distribution.
But what the percentage is, the final percentage number isn't calculated until all of the audited information is in, and the final student counts then are verified, and that will determine what that final percent is, and it may be off a percent or two from what the district saw at the beginning of the school year.
So I'm just, from perspective here, you get the nice runs. Tell us how much our district you're going to get per student.
Right.
Historically, my district has gotten about 90-91% of that figure when the checks are actually written.
Okay.
And so I'm just...
Because other districts underestimated their number.
Right.
Even though your district may have been exactly on the estimate for what the actual numbers were, because other districts weren't that accurate, it affected your school district.
Correct. I'm just curious in terms of, does that go away
No, that does not go away. Unless the school districts become better at estimating what the final weighted student count is. Because we're dealing with that student count for the current year, and that's something you don't know until the year's over.
So how is it going to be off by some factor?
I'm just curious, how we get that to.
Yeah.
Okay, this just puts some numbers again with different districts to try to show you a little bit how different districts are affected by the formula. The differences here, you'll see only in two lines of the teacher experience factor line, where A and B are increased by $25, C is decreased by $25. The other line that you will see different is the 70% transportation grant line, right? 200, 100, 150. So when you are looking at the amount per weighted student per district, there's only two factors that affect that, teacher experience and transportation. Only those two factors. That has to explain the differences that you see on a per weighted student basis. The facility grant, once that is a part of the numbers, will also come into play in that calculation. Those are the only two things that are going on to account for differences per weighted student. Okay, moving on to temporary constraints. We're only going to look at those for 9901. The constraints basically mean that there's three calculations for every school district. There's an equalization grant calculation, a flat grant calculation, which means that the revenue per student cannot be less than in the base year, which for 9901 biennium will be the 9899 revenue per student number. So, and then the stop-loss grant, which guarantees a district the same total revenue as it had in 9899, before applying the cap limit that we'll get to if the amount is over $4,800 the weighted student. So there's a number for each of these grants for every school district. And the formula then says, well, which is the highest? That's the amount that the district gets. So the flat grant and the stop-loss grant are constraints in that it has to be at least that much if the equalization grant is less than those amounts. Question? Okay. For 99-2000, the flat grant constraint is the lesser of 98-99 revenue per student that we just mentioned, or the 99-2000 cap, which we'll get through, aim for the stop-loss district. There's a limit on how much the flat grant and stop-loss grant can be. The calculation was adopted again by the 97 legislature and phased in over 3 years. For 98-99 was the first year that the flat grant and stop-loss grants were capped, and they were capped at $4,800 plus two-thirds of the amount above $4,800. So you take that $9,899 amount, look at the difference between that and $4,800, add two-thirds of that difference to $4,800, that's then how much that flat grant or stop-loss grant can be for $9,899. 99-2000, it's only one-third of the difference above $4,800, and then in 2001, limit is $4,800. So the idea in this process was, all right, take these higher revenue per student flat loss, flat grant, stop loss districts and begin gradually bringing them down to where the equalization amounts for those districts will be. So equalization amount gradually increasing over those three-year period, bringing the flat grant, stop loss districts down. Hopefully they meet without there being much of a gap, if any gap, in 2001. So perhaps in 2001, most of those districts will have an equalization grant very close to, if not above, $4,800. Again, depending on the funding level. If that's the case, then there'll virtually be no flat grant or stop loss districts even in 2001. But for sure, in 2001-02, unless legislation is changed. Here you can just see a picture that helps it be a little bit more understandable. In 98-99, you can see that you're adding only two-thirds of the amount that would have been above the $4,800 line and 33% in the 99-2000. Because of this, in some of the runs, you'll see that for a fat grant district or a soft loss district, the $99,000 amount for that district can be less than it was in 98-99 because of the limit, this cap coming into play because they're over $4,800. But not too many of those districts. Okay, just to kind of finish up, this tells you when the payments are made to the school district, kind of the end of the formula process, when are those formula dollars paid out. It's over the whole school year, but most of it comes on May 15th, which is the 25% payment for the year. May also represents several adjustments as the data is better by the time of school year. Okay, now, once that formula has been in place, what have been the results over the time period? Several different ways of looking at this. You can look at formula revenue, how it's changed over that time period. Generally increasing except in 93-94 when there was pretty much a across-the-board 5% reduction. The white boxes at the top for 97-98 and 98-99 represent the dollar amount outside the formula. So that's the $50 million one-time classroom needs grant in 97-98 and the $150 million lottery bond dollars in 98-99. The formula revenue per student, you can see how that's changed over that same time period. Generally increasing, and then you also see the effect of the spatial distributions for the last 2 years, again being the white portion of the bar for that. And again, this is on an ADMR, but it's not on a weighted basis. The reason is that we didn't have that same data for 90-91 and 91-92 when the weights weren't in effect yet.
And that's state and local revenue.
Yes. Then trying to adjust on a per student basis, adjusting for inflation. This is just an indication. You can get different results here depending upon what measure of inflation you use, when you start, and so on. So just use this as a general guide and take this chart with a grain of salt. This uses the U.S. CPI and goes back to 1991 as a starting point. What it basically shows you is that with student growth and inflation, we are at about the same per student level as back in 1991. Based on an ADMR measure, not a weighted measure.
Well, has certainly Oregon's CPI has not exceeded the national.
Generally, it does, because it's for just Portland. There isn't a state major for.
But Portland's 10% of the kids.
Yes.
And the rest of the state's lower than Portland.
Yes. That's why, well, in that chart, and why I tend to use the U.S. is because it is just for Portland else, and a large portion of the CPI is housing costs, and Portland housing costs tend to be higher than the rest of the state. So So whether that's a good choice or not is debatable.
Okay.
Okay, moving on to what the formula means for equity. We want to talk just a little bit about the concept of equity, where we're at with the current distribution, and then how has equity changed over this time period since the adoption of the formula. The equity is the current equalization formula, or the definition for equity in the context that we use it is the current equalization formula without the operating constraints. So if there were no flat grant crop loss districts, it's a permanent equalization formula. That's what we would consider the definition of equity is, and what the legislature considers equity to be from the formula. Okay. So it's a policy choice, and it can change and will change over time as the legislature makes changes to the formula. So it's not a fixed concept. It will change over time as the concept of what equity should be. It's like adding the new facility grant to the formula. That's going to be a change in how the legislature perceives equity for school districts as embodied in the formula. This is just an indication of what equity is in terms of how many rated students are funded from the equalization portion of the formula and how much are from the flat grant and crop loss constraint. Right, about 6% in 98-99 of the weighted students. Again, much lower than the number of districts, where it was about 38 or 39, I think, in 98-99. When you look at the 99-2000 runs at a probable funding level, or a minimum funding level, I guess I should say, the number of districts dropped, I think, to about 22. I don't have a percent of students, but it would probably going to be more like 4 or 5, or maybe even less than that percent of weighted students will still be flat grant and top law. And even though they're in that category, the overall funding level for those students will be less because of the $4,800 and the limit above that for some of those districts. Okay, what's the distribution? How much does it vary among the districts? Again, on a weighted student basis, you can see that 46% are between $4,500 and $4,600 per student. Another 42% are between $4,600 and $4,700. And so that's the bulk of the students, only being within a couple hundred dollars from high to low for them, all of those students. You have 3% that are about $4,700 to $4,900. 2% above $4,900 and 7% between $4,300 and $4,500. So none below $4,300, a few above $4,900 per student. And that will narrow again as in the next couple of years and then go away in 2001. Looking at it another way is to say, well, what percent of the students, how has that changed from 92-93, the first year of the formula, to 98-99? You can see the increase in the percent of students that are now funded through the equalization formula, increasing from about 70% to over 90%, and then just the reverse for the districts that were funded for the minimum constraint by the flat grant and stop loss provisions in the formula. So a lot of progress has been made over that time period in raising the funding dollar amounts and consequently raising the equalization amounts per student and replacing the flat grant and stop lower and stop loss districts with equalization dollars. Using a bar chart to kind of illustrate the same point, this is just for districts that are over 5,000 students. You can see the dashed red line at the bottom for those districts in order of the dollar amount per student. So that's a low revenue district with about $3,000, with over $3,000 per student, and the highest is over $5,000 per student back in 91-92. Now with 97-98 constrained, it's the blue line, and basically it overlays 97-98 equalization line for all of the districts except for two or three at the very end of the line on the right. So for almost all of the districts with over 5,000 students are equalization districts. I can't tell you offhand what the exceptions are.
I think what would be helpful for the committee is to get an example from a school district's perspective, whether it's an equity district or a stop-loss district, showing from their end how their resources are determined, including the local property tax, how that plays out in equalization that we're trying to achieve.
Yes, I could give you some district examples in terms of
the total resource of this amount that we're looking at. Is any of that the $5 a thousand at the local district that they run?
Well, how much
in the formula distribution when we're talking about the amount that we're distributing based on the ADM W? Is that the amount we're getting from the general fund, or does that include their contribution from their local property tax, or is that what we add on top of that that creates the inequity?
We are looking, have been looking in the formula at both state and local together equals something. And it's the state and local dollars that will make up that flat grant or that top loss grant. Equalization grant.
What I'm talking about, I think, would be helpful for the committee is to look at it from the district's point of view of where their resources are coming from, how equity districts need more help, how stop-loss districts, how they've gotten into the fix they're in. I think it gives us a better view if we're going to be massaging this formula to understand from the school district's point of view what this means.
We can talk about that in the context of what shows up in the database project, but I think what the answer will be is that everything is coming from the same sources for every district. It's a combination of state and local money.
Except that, I mean, I think what's confusing for a number of people, I've been on revenue before and I had a rough idea, but I mean, it seemed like it took me a while to get there. I think it's real difficult to get your arms around the issue of a stop-loss district and an equity district, and because we don't have anything here that explains that in detail, how much we're actually giving from the state general fund to a local district to make up what they raise in property tax. If we're going to be dealing with this for 18 months, it's good to get a real-life example of maybe even a real-life example from the point of view of an actual school district, how the ADMW works with the constituent students they have, and how it end up in the end gives them a certain amount of money and how they got there. I think that would be helpful.
You didn't hear my comments at the beginning of the meeting where I said we're not going to be at this for 18 months. We're not going to have the full interim. We're going to meet for, we don't have to determine exactly how many meetings, but draw some conclusions on this committee goals list. excluding number 7, and with the goal of trying to talk primarily about, from a policy point of view, what is fairness in the distribution process, which I think is relating to your question,
right.
Not getting into talking about what is the right amount, what is the appropriate cost per student, and getting into the curriculum issues and all those kinds of things. We're going to concentrate more on the distribution of the dollars that are available, whatever that may be.
Yeah, and I guess my other point is if we're going to be fine-tuning the distribution, it's good to understand it thoroughly so that you understand what it is you're changing.
Right. No question about that. This chart has always fascinated me because you try to look at it and think about it as time, but it's not time. It's districts,
in order.
And it's compared to 91-92 and compared to 97-98. So we're not looking at time. That one of the bottom axis is not time. It's amounts. And so I think what you can see there is the dramatic difference that occurred across the state for the amount of money per student that was expended when it was primarily a local effort compared to today when it's primarily a state-funded source. And maybe we don't like the end results of where the line is drawn, but at least we can see that it's pretty close, and we don't have those huge variations that we had in Boston.
And this also ties into the, and I don't know if this will come up in this context of this, of these hearings that we're going to have with the local option issue. It's related to the discussion.
Right.
If you have the local option, then you are going back to the 91-92 kind of graph, essentially, and you start that whole thing all over again.
Well, that's a matter of opinion, and we can talk about that. The local option is currently conceived would be allowing that mostly straight line to go up no more than 10% on a local option basis. And I think then again you start getting back into the definition of what is equity.
Uh-huh.
Equity is essentially what we as a legislative body determine to be equity within some broad parameters. So I think, Steve, I'd like you to, if you don't mind, if we just stop at this point. We'll talk about ESDs at a future meeting. We are kind of on the information overload, I think. It's been very helpful. It's always fascinating.
Got a question.
Do you see the local option question within the purview of the committee? I don't see it listed, but is that a discussion that you're going to have?
We can certainly talk about that. It's my impression at this point that we'll probably have that issue decided legislatively by the time the committee meets, in future meetings to talk about it. So we can talk about it from that point forward, not necessarily as a policy recommendation that we want to make for this particular session.
You may have better information than I have, so. When you talk about that time frame for decision on that issue, what is that time frame?
Prior to the signee die.
Okay.
And in concert distribution bill and the other distribution related education bills that need to come out of House Revenue Program.
Just to finish up, your test question is what causes the wiggles in the horizontal line?
Transportation and teacher experience.
Correct. You passed.
I'm sorry. I have a question also in regards to the dotted line, the 91-92 actual.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what impact school consolidation may have in relationship to the comparison between the solid lines and the dotted line there, if any?
I don't think there's any in this because this is only the larger district. And I don't know of any consolidations that took place for those districts that are represented here.
The other questions for Steve? Steve, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. issue. And before we adjourn, Walter, would you mind just giving us a couple of moments on what is the database and where it is?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Walter Kosher, Department of Education. The database initiative is in this biennium, is a pilot project for 16 districts. The districts involved range anywhere from Portland and Salem on the large size to Mitchell School District with less than 100 kids on the smaller size, Mitchell and Wheeler County. The need for the database initiative, I think, was driven for the desire to get better data from school districts. We had an accounting manual that school districts used, so they were supposed to be reporting to the Department of Education and to the constituents expenditure data in fairly similar manner, but it was not precise enough so we could do actual comparisons between districts. Also, there was a desire to determine what the level of funding should be. And I guess in conjunction with the quality education model, the database initiative folks have been working in trying to determine what the funding level should be. Nancy Heiligman, who was the business manager from Eugene on leave, is the project director. She's working with KPMG, who are the contractors. And they have been, creating an electronic data reporting format for all the school districts. That's been a big part of their charge, is developing a format that can be used in future years by all school districts in reporting data electronically to the Department of Education. The need for that is certainly obvious when you think of all the data requirements. There will be additional data reporting elements that districts are not going to be reporting. Right now, they're reporting on the school district level to us. The database initiative, starting with the 99-2000s, will require districts to report on a high school level. So instead of having 198 districts that will be reporting, we'll be getting data on approximately 1,200 schools. And the reports will be on the curriculum level. So we'll be able to tell you how much a school is spending, for example, for math. How much is being spent by a particular school for the ESL program. We have a funding formula that's in part driven by ESL students, but we have not been able to identify what are the actual costs of educating the ESL students. This will go, I think, a long way in being able to match, you know, what is being spent on ESL and what our districts are receiving for the ESL program. There are other components too, but one thing that I better mention is the part of the effort by the database initiative has been to rewrite the manual for the accounting manual for schools. All schools will be using the new accounting manual starting in 99-2000. As I said, it's much more detailed in terms of curriculum level. We'll be getting actual special education costs. We have not had that in the past. We've had parts of the special education costs, but never a whole picture of what special education costs are, including transportation, that has never been isolated. Also, there are other data items that they're looking at that are in the pilot project. I don't know how far, you know, whether this will continue or not, but they've looked at such items as volunteer hours at the school level, age of school buildings to try to get a handle on what the facility needs might be, those kinds of things. I think, you know, just kind of an overview, I'm not really the best person to talk about
this. Nancy
can do a great presentation on all the things they've done, but that's kind of an overview of what they've done.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bill, do you have any other questions?
So that we have 16 school districts today. And as we go through this process in the interim, we'll have how many school districts, how much data will we actually have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, if the database initiative is funded for the next biennium, that will bring all school districts into the database program. But there is a year of lag time. because they're working with audited data. So for at least for the next year or so, you will only have the 16 districts.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that update, and I'll ask Nancy to come to a future meeting. But
appreciate it. Mr. Chair, what's Nancy's last name?
Any other comments for the good of the order tonight? Appreciate you coming. This is an enormous undertaking again. What we'll do is have Stan to get in touch with our non-legislative guests as well as our legislative members to schedule the next meeting, get a more detailed agenda together, maybe get some, Leonard suggested a report from a particular school district that would actually show here's how they work through the budget, and start tackling these issues. We'll also address the ESD issue in more detail because having served on revenue the last three terms, I've seen that the ESD component of our not only our funding formula, but also of the services they provide, it varies widely across the state, and I think we need to get some consistency on that as well. So, any other comments? Thank you all very much for coming tonight. And